Welcome to Dairy Livestream. I'm your host, Corey Geiger, managing editor of Hordes Dairyman. We are broadcasting from our Cheese Cave, our studio in downtown Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, at the historic W.D. Hord & Sons Company building commissioned by Wisconsin's 16th governor and founder of our magazine, W.D. Hord. Our conversation today will focus, can dairy product exports power through port problems? I'm so pleased to have four great business leaders on this episode of Dairy Livestream to share their insight on this very important topic. As a reminder to everyone in our audience, this webcast will be available on our Hordes Dairyman YouTube channel 24 hours after the live event. Dairy Livestream is also available anywhere you'd like to listen to a podcast, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Search for Dairy Livestream from the convenience of your smartphone to download it. As you hear from our panelists, please submit your questions into our GoToWebinar control panel. The earlier you ask a question, the more likely it will get asked on air. Let's get rolling with the conversation. Can dairy product exports power through port problems? Before we hear from Gabriel Sevilla, let's go to a poll question. Roughly, what percent of shipping containers went from the U.S. to Asia empty in 2021? Your options are 10%, 30%, 50%, or 70%. So go ahead and answer that. We'll give everybody a little bit of time to answer that. And this is based on a lot of conversations with different people who work in this space and are experts in this space. So we're over 50% here, so let's go ahead and see what the audience thought. The audience thought, and this is from our West Coast ports, thought 44%. It's an amazing 70%. Again, 70% is the correct answer. So the reason, containers bound from Asia to the U.S. are fetching rates as high as $20,000 per container. Containers bound from the U.S. West Coast to Asia, so they'll be carrying U.S. goods at that point, are garnering $4,000 to $5,000. That disparity is causing shippers to race back to Asia empty to get more cargo. We welcome Gabriel Sevilla to Dairy Livestream. Gabriel has a distinguished career in the U.S. dairy industry with over 20 years of expertise in product marketing and distribution in the U.S., Latin America, and the Asian market. Throughout the years, Gabriel has worked as Director of Cheese and Manufactured Products at the U.S. Dairy Export Council, Vice President of International Whey Proteins for Dairy Farmers of America, and Vice President of the International Division for Agri Dairy Products based in Orange County, California. For the past 8 years, Gabriel has served as Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Proliant Dairy. Gabriel, let's get the audience up to speed on this entire conversation. What does it even take to get product from your facility in Michigan and Minnesota to a shipping vessel on the West Coast during normal circumstances?
Hello, Corey. Thank you for having us here today. It's a pleasure to be part of this distinguished group of panelists. Yes, shipping has become a major challenge, unlike anything we have seen in the past 20 years. So in the past, we would get an order from a customer. Our great logistics department would enter the order, and that's it. We would have the booking, and the product would ship from our facilities without any issue and reach the customer. Today, that transaction has to be touched at least 20 times before it actually reaches the port or the end customer. So it is a major issue. So just to give you an idea, today we have a minimum four-week lead time to get a new booking. This means that contract negotiations have to be done at least 6 weeks in advance, if not farther in advance, just to be ready to ship product in time to customers. All shipping details have to be provided by customers in a timely manner. Product then has to be produced with special SKUs, labeling, testing, and packaging that our customers require. We then have, once we get close to the booking time, we have to find the truck and the chassis to pick up the container. And finding containers in the Midwest today is very, very challenging. So in some cases, that product has to be trucked to a nearby city or a port in order to find that container. If we're able to find the container or the truck has to come to our plant. Container is then loaded, and then we have to deal with getting the container to a rail yard in a local city, in our case it's Minneapolis or Detroit, where the container is placed on top of the rail. There's many rail issues, congestion at rail yards, embargoes today from CP where they're not taking enough containers to meet their requirements. Just to give you an idea, we produce and ship about 500 containers and trucks per month. So you can imagine how this is, this issue is much greater than just shipping one truck. Once the product gets on the rail, we have to track the shipment and deal with possible delays, because if there's delays in the rail, we will not make the cutoff at the port. Once it gets to the port, there might be delays, missed bookings, container splits. We have to deal with canceled bookings. I know that the question was only to get it to the port, but after it leaves the port, there's additional delays in congestion with transshipment ports and destination ports that extends greatly the transit time to get product to our customers.
Well, Gabriel, I think listening to that very well thought out explanation, if anyone has flown anywhere on any trip and you miss your connection, or you had a flight delay and missed your connection, think of all the things that happen to complete your trip. And that's just for missing one connection. Think of all these other steps that Gabriel put in there. Gabriel, so this, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question here. The current shipping woes, and you shared that with me, are the worst you've seen in your lifetime. And it's even more challenging for Midwest shippers than those on the West Coast. Tell us a bit more about the current obstacles as it relates to exporting dairy products.
Well, I already mentioned a few of them. Supply chain was already challenging before COVID-19 started, but it completely broke down during COVID-19. Port congestion and rail congestion has been a major, major problem. And not only in the US, but internationally, ports of Singapore, Hong Kong were highly congested. For example, the port of Manila, which is one of our big destinations, was so congested that shipping lines canceled all shipments to this port, or most of them. As a result, also the transshipment ports of Singapore and Hong Kong, the barges that would fit Manila were redirected to other more profitable locations. The shipping lines did not want their ships having to wait around a month or two to be unloaded in the port of Manila. So, and this is just one example. So the service to these locations were completely canceled, leaving us for months without being able to ship to customers in those particular destinations. Just to give you an example, we then asked the ports of Singapore and Hong Kong were highly congested. We rerouted some of our shipments to other ports. In this case, it was some of the China ports. And as many of you have heard recently, Shanghai for the last over a month now has been in lockdown due to new COVID-19 cases. Because there were 600, or there's currently 600 to 700 ships waiting to be unloaded in Shanghai, many of those ships have been rerouted to other Chinese ports, making those ports congested. So everything that we do to reroute or be creative to get product to customers get affected by any element that might affect the already broken supply chain. We've seen issues with weather. There were major floods in the port of Vancouver, which we use regularly, November, December, that affected shipments. There's been port and rail strike threats. The Longshoremen's Union threatened a CP rail strike back in Canada, back in March. And as a result, we had to reroute product before that possible strike happened. The good thing was the strike never happened, but just the threat of that strike affected the supply chain completely. Now, there's obviously discussion of a possible strike in Long Beach, LA, current negotiations on the way. And again, even if that strike does not happen, it's already affecting the supply chain because we need to start rerouting shipments to other ports to prepare in case that actually happens. So any little thing that happens, it makes everything very, very complicated in the supply chain. So that's just a few examples that we're dealing right now. Obviously, ongoing booking issues, cancellations, delays, roles, splits in shipments. The other issue is because we're not able to ship product in a timely basis, we're having to use third-party warehouse to store our product. And space in third-party warehouses in the Midwest is today difficult to find and expensive. So that's one other element that makes the supply chain complicated today.
Do you ever take a day off, Gabriel? Because that's a lot to manage, and I'm being serious. I mean, you're probably getting calls at strange hours or texts or emails.
Yeah, not today. Yeah, we're working very long days. Customers are concerned, desperate, upset. So we're getting calls very early in the morning and very late at night as customers run out of product to keep their plants running. So everybody's concerned, stressed, and upset with the current supply chain issues. We are losing market share in some markets. The supply chain issue is bad worldwide, seems to be worse in the Midwest and other locations, but we are losing some market share, not only to other whey ingredient manufacturers, but to other ingredients as well, where customers are having to replace their requirements with other products just to keep their plants running. So that is obviously an ongoing stress. And unfortunately, yes, we're having to work very long days and weekends just to keep things more or less in order to our best of our ability.
Thank you. Before we hear from our next guest, Shauna Morris, let's go to another poll question. It's been estimated that seaport disruptions cost U.S. dairy shippers how much in 2021? $50 million, $500 million, $1 billion, and $1.5 billion. So there was a study done, National Milk Producers Federation and U.S. Dairy Export Council, and they put a number on it. And as you're answering that question, last year, U.S. dairy industry collectively exported $7.75 billion in dairy products. So U.S. dairy has grown from an infant to a significant player in the global arena when it comes to dairy product exports. So we're getting, we're just at the 50% mark. We're going to wait just a little bit more for people to answer that. And again, this is based on research by U.S. Dairy Export Council, National Milk Producers Federation, and other dairy groups. So let's go ahead and see what the audience had to say. We're closing the poll. 43% of you got that estimate right, 1.5 billion. Indeed, the U.S. dairy industry could have achieved over 9 billion in dairy product exports last year had seaports and other modes of transportation not seen such a high hurdle last year. It's my pleasure to welcome Shauna Morris to Dairy Livestream. Shauna is a Senior Vice President of Trade Policy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council. With over two decades of experience in this area, Shauna works actively to advance and promote dairy trade policies that grow the U.S. dairy industry, and she plays a critical role in that at the National Milk Producers Federation efforts, working with U.S. and foreign governments, as well as various international organizations. Shauna works closely with the U.S. Dairy Export Council, developing and promoting the international policy interests of U.S. dairy farmers and the wider U.S. dairy industry domestically and around the world, as trade policy becomes an increasingly key factor in the economic well-being of U.S. dairy farmers. Shauna, from my perspective, you have no shortage of work these days. With overflowing plate, what have you been focusing your area and attention on to assist U.S. dairy to fulfill export orders with customers around the globe?
Oh, thanks for that, Corey, and thanks so much for holding this. I think it's a really timely topic, and just appreciate the chance to be able to be on this really strong panel, pulling together so many of the different threads on this issue. Our focus on this really goes back to roughly early last year, which is when it topped over onto our plate, I'd say, as an issue that was really presenting tremendous challenges for so many of our members. And great, Gabriel did a great job outlining the examples of that from just one company's perspective, but we've been hearing about it from so many of our exporters for the last year and a half now. So one of the first things we did was create a working group of key members impacted by this that were dealing with most of the challenges to really start to provide some input into us as staff on where the pinch points are, what were some of the things that could be helpful here, and then begin to craft recommendations. I'd say our focus really has been on how do we change the regulatory and policy and legal landscape here to try to upend the situation. Clearly by now, the commercial situation has not sorted itself out, and clearly this is not sustainable where we are now. So looking at how do we work through Congress and at the same time through the administration to try to bring the government to bear in targeted ways that could be helpful to changing those dynamics. And, you know, frankly, if anything, I think this has become even more pressing over the last month or so here as the global food security crisis has really heightened. A lot of these products, of course, are not going to the most destitute around the world, but the greater the difficulties are in moving the types of dairy products that we're talking about here out to foreign customers, the tighter the supplies are for what people need to eat around the world at a time when we can't afford to be putting any more stress on that system. And I think that's something we've been working to try to help ensure policymakers understand more clearly. I'll just talk about a couple of those efforts, maybe starting first on the congressional side, because that's been a big slice of the focus, is once we recognized together with others in agriculture, really how outdated our shipping legislation is, and the lack of teeth that the regulatory body has in this space. The Federal Maritime Commission is charged with overseeing what happens here, but really didn't seem to have the tools they needed to require them or to allow them, depending on how you look at it, to crack down on the types of abuses that we were seeing. So we've been strong supporters in working with members of Congress to advance the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. That passed overwhelmingly in both the House and the Senate and would include a number of new disciplines. No silver bullets here. There are none on an issue as complicated as this, but a number of new requirements to help nudge things in a better direction. And most importantly, provide some incentives and requirements on the carrier side of things, specifically to help encourage greater exports. That's headed into conference at this point to try to reconcile some of the differences between the House side and the Senate side. And our focus on that is on twofold, making sure that does move forward so that we actually see final legislation passed, and critically making sure that it has the key provisions specifically focused on supporters supporting exports that we need to see in order for it to have the type of impact we want to have. And then at the same time, I'll just touch shortly too on in parallel what we've been doing with the administration, because Congress is not a fast route, unfortunately. Nothing in the government is, but particularly passing legislation takes quite a while to go through the whole gauntlet. So throughout this process, we've also been working to identify specific steps the administration could take to try to help bring some near-term relief. We were very supportive of the pop-ups launched in Oakland and Seattle. We certainly want to see continued work to make sure those are ironed out and working as effectively as they can. But we've also been strongly advocating, particularly with USDA, Department of Transportation, and the White House, about the need for additional tools, some inland pop-up locations and incentives to be able to make those viable and workable, greater transparency, such as renewing container tracking report the USDA used to do that we've heard has been really helpful in terms of actually knowing where the containers are and where they're headed. And ideally, we'd like to see additional investments from the federal government to help incentivize export-related fast lanes at ports. You know, priority for goods that are headed out the door for the trucks carrying those products, and incentives for carriers that commit to greater export promotion, export product on their ships, to be able to have preferential berthing and locations, anything we can do to really try to nudge the incentive structures that are in place right now.
Thank you, Shauna. I appreciate that very much. I want to remind our audience, as you hear from Gabriel and Shauna, and we're going to hear from Andrew and Mark next, if you think of a question you'd like to ask, go ahead and type it into the GoToWebinar control panel. There's a question panel there, and we will get those answered in the second half of our program. So let's go straight to the next poll question. A top 10 U.S. seaport, Oakland directly employs how many people? 393, 1,393, 11,393, or 111,393. So go ahead. This will give everybody in the audience a little bit of appreciation for size, scope, and scale of our seaports. You know, we talk a lot about airports oftentimes, but seaports are quite a different organization. So we're going to wait till people get to the midway point here on that poll question, and then we will carry on with the conversation. So let's go ahead and see what the audience had to say. 59% of you got it right, 11,393. So the Port of Oakland, that's a Northern California port, employed 11,393 people as we entered into the pandemic, making it a very dynamic business. In California, only the Port of Long Beach and the Port of Los Angeles employ more people. And those are America's two largest ports based on shipping volume. I'm delighted to have Andrew Wang on Dairy Livestream. Andrew is manager of maritime business development and international marketing at the Port of Oakland. He leads a team of five who are responsible for Oakland Seaport's marketing, business development, and customer relations. Before joining the Port of Oakland, Andrew spent over 25 years in international logistics on both the shipper and provider sides. Most recently, he worked for Hyundai Merchant Marine, where he managed port and export sales for its Pacific Southwest and Gulf region. Before that, he worked for APL, Sealand, CSX, and EVA Air. Andrew, our shipping woes didn't happen overnight, and some of these issues were even brewing before the pandemic. Can you walk us through some of these matters and potential remedies?
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for having me, and it's an honor to be on this great panel. I think the one main issue that we are all facing today is infrastructure. So infrastructure, you know, almost by definition is expensive and it takes a long time. So any projects that you would have or that you would need to be have started many years ago. Over the past decade or so, the East Coast ports have been funded to a 10-to-1 ratio versus the West Coast ports for federal infrastructure dollars. And I think we have seen now the toll that that has taken on the shippers. We saw many of these issues going on prior to, but they were, I would not say easily, but they were quickly remedied just because there were no surges, there were no delays. And, you know, if you see a delay of 1 or 2 days, it's probably acceptable compared to delays of 2 to 3 months that we are seeing today. So I think that, you know, if there was one key component to kind of the long-term issues that we are seeing here, I think infrastructure is part of that. Other issues that I believe really are affecting what is going on, we can't not forget that COVID still rages. Yes, here in America, I think as I travel around the country, starting to feel more comfortable with the situation. But if we remember just 3 months ago, when Omicron was at its peak, we had a lot of people out, and that has caused quite a bit of delay, and that delay caused congestion at ports, and then consequently ships cannot be unloaded. I think in some sectors we were hearing that the sick call out rate was upwards of 30 to 40% on any given day. So warehouse jobs are not one of those remote work jobs. You physically have to be at a warehouse to unload containers and load containers. And if you're dealing with shortage of staff, that really does throw a chain. And if you multiply it thousands and thousands of times, collectively, we see what we see today. And I think the other aspect is congestion. I always like to remind people, and Gabriel mentioned it, is this is a global phenomenon. This is not limited to the East Coast, to the West Coast, Asia, Europe. I was just reading AlphaLiner this morning, and they tracked delays going through Europe, averaging probably anywhere between 19 and 32 days longer for rotation. So these issues are global. They're not just limited here. So just getting your cargo onto a vessel doesn't mean that you're not going to see problems when that vessel arrives at destination. What are we doing at the port to try to help this? Shauna mentioned we have a pop-up yard that has opened up. USDA will be finalizing the reimbursement process to help the US exporters if they're pulling empties out of this yard, also when they're staging full containers for export loading. What else are we working on? We are now putting in applications to be able to take advantage of some of the money that has been set aside for ports to be able to get some of our existing port land up and running for multiple uses, such as additional pop-up yards, or we have one whole terminal that needs upgrading to be able to take the new class modern vessels. And then I think the last thing that we are working on is technology. We have a freight intelligent transportation system that's going live in third quarter of this year. And it really will tell all the port users at any moment what is going on in the port. It tracks all trucks that come in. You can tell what the queues are outside the gate. You can see what the truck turn times are. You can see where the traffic is. And this will help port users understand better what is going on, you know, the day that you're trying to get containers into the terminal against the cutoff. So I'll leave it there, and you know, any further questions?
I haven't been to see a pop-up port yet. Can you use your words to paint a picture to the audience what that might look like?
Yeah, so we took about 22 acres at a one of our pieces of land at the port, and what we have done is we've actually leased it out to a terminal operator who has come in, acquired container handling equipment. So this container can be used to not just park chassis and containers, but actually you can take containers off the chassis and be able to stack those containers. The benefit of that is that you are freeing up chassis in the market, and chassis is one of the big components of congestion. If you don't have chassis to go around, then containers can't be. By my estimate, we have probably freed up anywhere between 1,000 and 1,200 chassis in the market just through the through this pop-up yard in the last 30 days. So it is contributing to the fluidity in the market. But what happens in a pop-up yard is trucks will come in, they will take off the empty containers that they brought in. Oftentimes the terminals are congested, cannot take any more additional empty containers. So this is an overflow lot for those containers. And then ideally what we want is for exporters to pull containers from this location to go out to load and then come back into the actual ocean terminals to stage to load onto vessels. Oftentimes, I think, Gabriel was mentioning one of the issues is the ever-moving vessel cutoffs because of the berthing schedule. So this pop-up yard also allows the ability to stage a loaded container hold it literally, I think, about a quarter mile from the closest ocean terminal and wait a day or two before the window opens. And then the truck will go back in, pull it out, and put it into the ocean terminal. This helps the exporters tremendously, and we know many of the exporters are already taking advantage of this.
Thank you, Andrew. And I like that 22-acre term here because farmers used to talk in that 40-acre parcels. So here, so half of a 40 acres on your farm, if you're in the dairy farming community, gives a good frame for that pop-up port. Before hearing from Mark Stevenson, let's go to our final poll question. Prior to the pandemic, the U.S. was short 61,500 truckers. That has grown to what number? 61,500, 70,000, 80,000, or 90,000? So go ahead and answer that question. And as you're answering that question, a reminder to the audience, if you have a question for our panel, go ahead and type it in the GoToWebinar control panel, and we'll get that asked here, answered here after we hear from Mark Stevenson. So let's go ahead. We're right over the 50% mark. We'll see what the audience had to say. The correct answer, at least according to the American Trucking Association, is 80,000 truckers. Who knows, it may have grown to 90,000, or it feels like that certainly to our audience members that are working in this space. But that means we struggle even to get products to seaports. We welcome the University of Wisconsin's Madison's Mark Stevenson to the program. Mark, you've been with us since the pandemic started as we've worked through issues on dairy live stream. Mark, can you tie this together as it relates to can dairy product exports power through port problems? Mark, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Corey. You know, and I think this is really very timely because I'm not sure that we've ever had a better opportunity to think about increasing export sales. International demand has held up surprisingly well given the circumstances of the past couple of years. And our port or export competitors have been facing some milk production problems that I think will probably outlast COVID and our current supply chain disruptions. You know, for instance, the EU in general, and specifically countries like Netherlands, Ireland, and Germany, are constraining production due to environmental issues. New Zealand's been experiencing drought this year, and they expect production to be well down, but in the longer run, that country is also feeling as though there are too many animals on too small a footprint. So production growth is going to be difficult for them. But if I think more about our current port issues, I think the root cause of a lot of these things is the labor shortage. Now, COVID precipitated this or exposed the labor problem to us, and we want to blame the pandemic for all kinds of the supply chain issues, but the truth is that it probably had more to do with demographics than COVID. There's a big portion of the population that's just getting older, and it's a supply chain issue that's going to take some time to work itself out. You know, for example, you mentioned in the pop-up poll here that trucking industry estimates that's currently short about 80,000 drivers, and that's a historic high. And the problem is most acute for long haul or non-local movements. And that really is hitting a lot of the dairy land. Much of this has to do, the average age of drivers is high and retirements are happening all the time. So salaries are increasing rapidly to try and attract more drivers. But even perversely there, we see that some drivers are choosing to work less at the higher wage. It's something that economists would call we're satisficing. So if I can earn a reasonable living, I maybe don't want to take as many of those long haul jobs and stay home a little more. The ports have also been experiencing those labor issues. Mentioned a little bit, the longshoremen and port workers have not been in a better position to negotiate wages in the current time. And talks are currently underway with about 22,000 workers at about 29 of the West Coast ports, through which about half of our dairy products are sent overseas. So workers are, of course, looking for better wages, but even other things. And one of them, the major position, is to limit automation of cargo handling facilities. And that's something which the port modernization that Andrew mentioned would really want to do. And finally, even if our labor shortages and inflation problems were magically resolved overnight, it would still take time for the supply chain disruptions to smooth themselves out. The folks who model such things say that it's a little like fast moving and crowded traffic on a freeway. When one car gets a little too close and taps on the brakes, it sets off a chain reaction of the other cars behind them tapping on their brakes. And before you know it, there's a long delay with backed up traffic for no particular reason. It may take a couple of years just to smooth out the supply chain disruptions once the underlying problems are addressed. So I'm not sure this is a short-term issue for us. I think it's a longer-term problem.
Well, thanks for that great news, Mark, but we appreciate hearing the truth. And I think we do need to talk more about that. You know, we're going to go, we got a number of questions in the queue here, but I think one of the ones we got to talk about first here, Andrew, one of the good news items, the number of ships waiting to berth in the port on the West Coast is about as low as it's been in a long time. But on the flip side, there's a lot of ships waiting to unload in China. So we could have a good situation forming on the U.S., but then we could have a lot of ships coming back eventually. Talk a little bit about those numbers, the current state of affairs.
So I would say that I think my last reading, there might be about 29 vessels waiting to get into the LA Long Beach complex in the queue. I think that's the slowest it's been since maybe December of 2020. What I would say is that any respite that we have is welcome. Allows the terminals to catch up. As of this morning, Port of Oakland had 4 ships waiting, but we had a couple berths open, and it's just a snapshot. So I'm sure a couple of those ships will be coming in. What does this mean? It means that our labor has been processing the vessels as fast as they can. It means that there is some fluidity in the network. People are picking up their containers, though not as quickly as we hope. We know that some of our terminals are at plus 90% capacity. What remains to be seen is what happens when China opens up. So I think Shanghai has started opening a slow open, targeting to be open fully by June the 1st, assuming that there's no further setbacks. At that point, we will see what flood of cargo comes in from the provinces that surround Shanghai, where the vast majority of those products are made. At that point, I think ocean carriers will then make routing decisions. I do think we were going to see an uptick in vessels when Shanghai opens up. Whatever temporary respite we can get, we're very happy because it gives us a chance to catch up and then sort of get prepared for that next wave. I think many analysts are saying that we're going to have a very strong shipping probably all the way through first quarter of next year for the imports. And ultimately, that affects the exports.
Anyone from our panel want to add anything to that from what they've learned? Because we all see different reports and hear different things.
I would just ask a question. Maybe Andrew might know. You indicated like 4 ships waiting in Oakland, but if I remember reading correctly, I think it was like 300 or 400 ships waiting for Shanghai to be unloaded. At some point in time, that's a lot of ships that aren't on the ocean moving to other ports. So that's going to be an issue, isn't it?
I think so, but I think we have to first remember that Shanghai is one of the main one of the main transship hubs for cargo. And so you have a lot of intra-Asia cargo, you have Asia Europe, Asia Middle East, along with the Trans-Pacific, and then you also have Asia, South America, and Asia, Africa. So of all those ships, those 300 are all coming to the United States. And then I think from there right now, many of the ocean carriers are trying to decide what to do with ships, particularly the ones that have arrived later versus the ones that have arrived earlier. If the ones that have arrived later, they may decide to skip unloading Shanghai cargo at another port and then move it back to Shanghai. So these decisions are being made at headquarters around the world. So it's very too early to tell, you know, what that real impact is going to be until some decisions are made.
If I can add to that just real quick, we usually have a lot of problems with lack of containers after Chinese New Year. even just before Chinese New Year starts. And then after Chinese New Year, we see a major, what we call the Chinese New Year hangover, where there's a lack of containers coming in to the US, and that results with less containers getting to the Midwest for us. So this delay is caused by COVID-19 closures will be, I think, an extended or even larger effect than Chinese New Year, where we'll unfortunately again, I believe, see a lack of containers coming back to the U.S. to be loaded with agricultural products. So that is one of our current fears, that this delays in China will cause delays in containers coming back to the U.S.
And for those who don't know the calendar here, for example, the U.S. and Europe and Latin America would celebrate New Year on the traditional January 1. Chinese New Year is about 3 weeks later, so it's a little bit different cycle there. And it's also a big shopping time within the country of China and many of its Asian neighbors. So let's talk about the whole intermodal system. And intermodal would include ports and trucking and loading and all that. We're talking about some upgrades that are happening here. Shauna, you work in this a lot too, but what do you think are some of the next intermodal supply chain portions that are primed for maybe some automation or some robot type work? What have you been hearing when you talk to people?
Well, maybe I'll start just from our side. I'd say probably still the most that we hear about the valuable role that automation can play more is on the port side of thing, particularly some of the ports that haven't made those investments quite as much, and less so on some of the other pinch points, at least, that our members have raised to date. On the trucking piece, that's been a core slice of what we've been working on and talking about too. But the kind of people removal piece there that has a lot of discussion in terms of automated vehicles, obviously still not a solution that's on the horizon at this point. So a lot more of our focus has been on how do you move more quantity, more tonnage with the existing trucks? How do you increase flexibilities for the drivers in the meantime?
Yeah, I think, Corey, one of the interesting things about that in particular is that there may be an intermediate solution between full automation of trucking that a lot of people are a bit nervous about. And at least on the interstates, they're talking about having some truck trains, you know, that may go down the highway. So you've got a lead truck with a driver in it that's making a lot of the decisions, but maybe four or five or six trucks right behind him are just automated, and you know they are moving with that front truck and slowing down and stopping and so forth as that driver makes decisions. So you know you can maybe get three or four trucks worth of material with one driver.
Here's a question here just to get size and scope, and maybe nobody has the answer. Andrew might be able to take a stab at it. One of the audience members says, how many containers are there worldwide, and what is the estimate? So how many containers are there? And if you know a ballpark of that, how many are at ports at any one time? And that's a tough question to answer, but I think it's curious here.
Globally, I would not have any idea about what the gross total number of containers there are, but if you use normal traditional figures when things are not congested, depending on, let's just take a very simple Shanghai to LA service, four vessels can make that run back and forth. You would need one container on each ship, and then you need one and a half in Shanghai, one and a half in LA, or unloading and loading. And that is to maintain a fixed day weekly service. Now, when you start adding ports to it, then you have to start adding containers to it. And that's under normal circumstances. As you now start to see these delays, you know, sometimes running 40 days longer, you literally need to move the same amount of volume, probably an additional 20 containers, just to move that same volume. So there is a real world cost, and the containers, you can't manufacture that fast enough when you see a huge bump in the demand for those containers.
So here's an important question. So USDA, and this comes another audience question, USDA is doing the work with the Port of Portland on this big pop-up port. How do we encourage other agricultural shippers, suppliers, the Gabriels of the world, to use that new pop-up port? Ideas?
Well, I can speak to it because I live it every day, right? So there are many components to making it successful. The first one is ensuring carrier participation. So the ocean carriers need to make sure that they want to participate because there is an actual real cost to them to put the containers in there. So I know USDA has been having conversations. We've been having conversations, and I always implore all the shippers to talk to their carriers to tell them that, hey, I need you to put some empties into the pop-up yard. So that would be, you know, one of the biggest components of getting making the pop-up yard more effective. But that is just one of the benefits, is making empties available so that the truckers don't necessarily need to go into the ocean terminal to wait and pick up a container. They can walk, they can, without an appointment, go right into the pop-up yard, pull an empty, and go out to load. But, you know, success is defined many different ways, but I think the most important thing right now is to ensure that all the main carriers are participating.
So a lot of this here, we can solve problems, but we have a lot of costs in here. Are exporters from other countries also having to add additional freight costs? How is this affecting the market overall in general? Shauna, or Mark, do you want to talk about that from a little bit bigger scale picture, and then we'll come over to Gabriel and Andrew?
Sure, happy to start a little bit. I'd say for quite a while, certainly what we were hearing is that our biggest competitors, primarily from the EU, from New Zealand, sure they were contending with shipping challenges, but not on the magnitude of what you've been hearing about today and the US exporters have been having to deal with. In talking to at least colleagues from the European Union more recently, when they were here for visits, that seems to have increased in terms of the pressure and the challenges that they're dealing with at this stage as well. They definitely spoke to things having become much more difficult even than they were previously. I'd say still what a lot of our foreign offices are reporting, particularly in some of those key Asian markets, and I'd say at the top of that list, unfortunately, being Southeast Asia, is the fact that that their importers' perception is that this is much more a challenge coming from the US in terms of the reliability, the timing of delivery, compared to some of those other suppliers. In the case of New Zealand, obviously, have a proximity advantage there for some of the markets too, and it gives them a little bit of a natural leg up, particularly in terms of the shipping flows. I'll see what Mark can add from a more detailed perspective from his angle, of course.
Well, I'm not sure I can add a lot more, but, you know, honestly, when you think about the kind of costs that Andrew had talked about, that maybe a $20,000 premium, you know, to get a container on the Asia side to get it out, you know, we've moved from maybe $3,000 or $4,000 to ship that container over to $20,000. That begins to add up on pounds of powder or cheese or other dairy products. But, you know, on the cost of my iPhone, it's pretty trivial. And I'm not really sure that that's being worried about on some of these high margin, high value items as much as it is on more commodity related products. So I think that it's not symmetric.
I commend the development of pop-up container yards in the West Coast ports. I think it's a great idea, and anything that we can do to help ease congestion will help us indirectly. But again, for most facilities located in the Midwest, like ours, having to truck product to the port is non-sustainable, especially for high quality, low cost ingredients that we are shipping overseas, adding 11, 12 cents per pound to truck, or sometimes even more, to truck this type of products to the port makes it uncompetitive. And we had to do some of this because we had no option to get product to our customers. But different from our from an iPhone, as commented by Mark, a lot of dairy products cannot sustain that increase in cost. So that is a major issue. We are seeing other countries, just on the second question, we're seeing other countries also having logistic issues. It is happening to other main exporters like Europe and Oceania. Nevertheless, I think in some cases, especially from the Midwest, delays might be a little bit higher, adding maybe 30 to 45 or, additional days in transit time.
I'd say Gabriel's last point there, particularly from the upper Midwest location compared to some of our competitors. I mean, if you think about the scale of the US and where we're exporting a decent chunk of our dairy from, where a lot of our farms are, compared to some of those key competitors, that their countries are just much smaller, and the exporters are going to be naturally positioned closer to some of the port facilities versus the distances companies like Gabriel's have to travel to be able to get product out.
And Shauna, you're maybe able to talk to this too, but you know, we're getting enthusiastic about our increase in cheese sales, for example, or butter sales. They've been pretty small in the past, but growing now. That's a different product. I mean, when you've got to get reefer containers and not just dry containers, when you're worried about whether that's going to get stuck in a port somewhere for 30 days, that's a different product. We have to worry about those things a little more. Okay,
so let's go to another question. And Andrew, we'll take this one to you. Once berthed, how long might it take a ship to get unloaded or unloaded? So go ahead and walk through that example a little bit, just so people understand that process as well.
So you're talking about loading and unloading a vessel. Well, first of all, it's going to depend on the size. Your smaller ships, you know, the 2,200, 2,500 TEUs, you can probably work the entire vessel in about 36 hours to 48 hours. Your larger ships, the 14, 15,000 will probably take up to upwards of 6 days to load and unload. And then as you get into the even larger size vessels, depending on how many cranes you can put up against the vessel, you're minimally 7 to 8 days on those. And then again, it all depends on which port you are and the efficiencies or how fast they can, you know, they're able to load and unload the ships.
Shauna, this question may not be related to this broadcast, but it is on the headlines right now. And I'm going to throw it your way because you've probably talked about it some. And if anyone else wants to jump in, while not necessarily an export specific issue, much of the current supply issues for infant formula are related to a shutdown of a plant in Michigan. How have and will these general supply chain issues, will they be mitigated in the near or short term? Over the next, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. And the reason I do ask that a little bit, because when I was in Vietnam, for example, I mean, here in the United States, we'll put security measures or, you know, I'm forgetting the right word, but we'll put security to prevent people from stealing shirts in our stores. And in Vietnam, they don't care about that. They'll wrap it around infant formula. So infant formula is really important. There's key components of it that are exported. But now we have a problem here in the U.S. on it, too. Anything you're hearing on that?
Happy to comment just shortly. We have been getting quite a lot of questions about this over the last week, too. I'd say a positive indication, I think, is the recent announcement this week about the steps to reopening that plant. We only have a limited number of plants even making these products, of course, throughout the U.S. It's hard to find a solution to a problem of this magnitude without getting back that scale online. particularly tying back into the supply chain discussion here, since it, you know, it has been floated, and certainly one thing that could be explored is looking at, can we temporarily bring in some of this product from certain markets that might be well trusted as well? But that's not immediate, and may not address the time sensitivities of some of these situations fully as well.
Thanks for catching that curveball. We had a couple audience members asking about it, so I thought we should at least talk about that timeliness of that. The ports throughout the world, they're pretty well established. Some of them may be older than others. Are there opportunities for major upgrades? And maybe we should just talk about our U.S. ports here. We have enough issues at home here. We don't need to be telling others in other countries what to do. But are there some opportunities to enhance our ports? You know, Andrew, you live at each and every day. Others have talked about it. Anyone want to jump in on that one? Another audience question here. And some of this takes money. Some of it takes time. It takes resources. I understand all that.
I think as a port authority, we're always looking at different ways to increase the throughput. There is not much land on the West Coast for additional terminals. And so the only way you can increase the volume is to increase the throughput. So we are constantly looking at various ways to do that, working in partner with the ILWU labor, working in partner with the PMA to understand what some of the issues are, the Pacific Maritime Association, which represents the terminal and the ocean carriers. So we're constantly working on that as well. But I think the other aspect too is, are there ways to reevaluate how cargo is moved? And I think, you know, one of the main points that I try to talk about is things will never be the way they used to be pre-COVID. You know, you see the lack of containers in the Midwest, and as long as the ocean carriers have pricing power to not take containers to the Midwest, they won't. I mean, I have seen the import pricing structures this year, and I can tell you that there is a deliberate strategy to disincentivize containers going into the interior. They would much prefer that they get stripped out, transloaded on the West Coast, and then containers go back to Asia. That being said, as you move forward, particularly if you're exporting from the Midwest, I think you really need to really look at how you're going to move your cargo. And it may not be a scenario where you're always going to have containers available. You may have to put it in a boxcar and move it to the West Coast and transload in the West Coast. You know, in particular, if you're talking about refrigerated products, there might be fewer and fewer refrigerated containers going into the Midwest. So how do you look to move the refrigerated product to the coast? So in Oakland, that is what I work on when I do planning is, how are we going to plan the facilities for the shippers to be able to utilize, that type of a logistics program? I really do not believe it will go back to where it was pre-COVID. And I think people need to prepare for that.
Mm-hmm. And so people can appreciate, you know, there are only so many natural ports in the world. Very unique situation in the Persian Gulf. Actually, the port of Dubai is man-made. That is extremely expensive, literally digging earth and sand and dumping it somewhere else. I mean, if you see the different, the palm trees in that Persian Gulf, that's really because they moved the sand somewhere else to create a port. So, and obviously people like to live by water. So then you have denser populations there. So creating additional space in these areas is almost astronomical. So with that, anything that any of the panelists want to add here is on any of these topics before we wrap up Dairy Livestream?
Well, maybe I'd just like to add a huge kudos and thank you to our exporters for the blood, sweat, and tears that they are exerting in order to move this product. You know, maybe just looping back to the beginning, the fact that with all of this going on and the huge challenges that Gabriel detailed so well, that we still were able to achieve such a record number of exports last year and have hope for a bright export scenario this year too. It's a lot of work. It's extremely difficult. It's hard to see how our exporters keep that up kind of long-term looking down the road, which is why we're all talking about how do you solve some of these issues. But they really are to be commended for doing so much to keep product moving and finding a way to make it happen.
I think that's a perfect place to end this. Our next dairy live stream, Let's Talk Federal Order Fixes, will air on Wednesday, June 15th at 11 a.m. Central Time and will be archived on the Hordes Dairyman YouTube and podcast channels the very next day. We look forward to seeing you then. On behalf of Gabriel, Shauna, Andrew, Mark, and I am Corey Geiger, your host. Thank you for joining us today. We wish you all a good day. Goodbye, everyone.